So we're in chapter 3, halacha 9, and we are discussing, this is the Rambam's list of people who do not merit a share in the world to come. So he's going to have at the end 24 examples, is what he says is the count, and we've already seen, I don't know, maybe 8 or 9 at this point, and we're going to go through some more today, and hopefully start chapter 4 as well. So halacha 9 begins, that there's two types of people we refer to as mumrim. The word mumar in Hebrew, I guess you would translate as somebody who has rebelled against Judaism. So we had examples of those who were non-believers. That doesn't mean they're rebellious, necessarily. We had people who may, and I mean different types of non-believers. A lack of belief in God, or they think God could be portrayed in a physical form. They don't believe in the Torah, or in the tradition from the rabbis. That's necessarily rebellious, that's just a lack of belief. They're not the same. Now, mumar is somebody who does something which we would call rebellious. The two examples of a mumar are the following. Rambam says the first example we refer to as a mumar l'aver achas. He is a rebel for one avera, one sin. So this person is dedicated and devoted to most of the Torah, but there's one area of the Torah this person just rejects. And that person, and the other person is called mumar kol Torah, somebody who rejects the entire Torah. And now he explains what those mean. A mumar l'aver achas, somebody who is considered rebellious in one area. This is somebody who constantly performs this sin, this transgression, purposely, in a routine way, and does it publicly. And even if it's one we look at as an insignificant or a lesser sin in the Torah, not like he's a murderer. It could be it's something which we look at as kind of a minor detail in the Torah. This person does it in a rebellious manner, constantly, on purpose. An example the Rambam gives is such as wearing shatnez. This person, shatnez, you can't wear wool and linen together. That's the halacha in the Torah. So this person is well aware of this halacha. They know the Torah prohibits wool and linen together. And yet they go to the store and they purposely will buy clothing made of shatnez and wear them all the time. And it doesn't bother them. Or, he says, the other example the Rambam gives is somebody who cuts off their payas. Just to elaborate on that halacha for a second, we picture payas these long side locks that we see Hasidim have, but that's the Hasidim, that's a custom which they have, which they look at as something very holy, something which is Kabbalistically considered a very nice thing to do. But the Torah prohibits cutting off payas, which just means, you know, shaving, and it's only for a male, and just shaving this area of the head, basically to the skin, more or less, so you can't grab any hairs. So there's a few spots in the head which you have to have hair on. And that's called, that's the mitzvah of keeping pace. The fact that they grow them out long is coming from a different source. It's more of a Kabbalistic idea. But so let's say a person says, I know the Torah says that you cannot shave off this area of the head, and I don't even particularly like that kind of haircut, but I'm going to do it anyways, because I'm being rebellious. I think that mitzvah is silly, I don't want to accept it, I'm going to rebel against it and do it. So that person, even though it's just one, what we would consider a somewhat minor area of the Torah, that person is considered a mumar l'aver achas, a rebel in one area. And then the Rambam says, that's if the person is doing it. Oh, okay, skip the line. And it turns out this person is kind of just canceling out a mitzvah of the Torah as if it doesn't exist. And that's only the person is doing it in order to rebel and anger God. Meaning that there is a big difference, halachically, between somebody. We have people who, all of us, you know, we have our issues, you know, we're not perfect. But a lot of times we do it not because we're rebellious, just because it's a difficult challenge that we have. Let's take someone who's trying to keep kosher, and they used to love eating cheeseburgers. It's very hard for them to drop the cheeseburger. Not eating cheeseburgers to rebel against God, but it's just that, you know, they have a desire, and there's an appetite which draws them in. And they feel bad about it. So that's not considered a mumma, that's not rebellious, that's not a rebel. That person can still be sure in the world to come. But someone who says that I'm past cheeseburgers, I don't have a desire to eat a cheeseburger, that's not what's pulling me in. But I think it's a silly law. I'm going to go and eat cheeseburgers just to rebel against God. I think it's a silly law. That's a mumar l'aver achas. Even the person may be perfect in all of their 612 mitzvos, the person loses their share in the world to come. Because what they've done is they've eradicated one part of the Torah. They said, this part of the Torah I don't care about. It doesn't exist for me, and I'm going to rebel against God with that part of the Torah. So that's a mumar l'aver achas.
Is the world to come after we die, or is the world to come when the Messiah comes? How are they using it?
How the Rambam's using it, he's talking about eternal existence.
Eternal
existence.
Is this only for public, if you do something in public?
That's what he says. It's as if it's a public act.
Right.
So even if a person does this privately, is rebellious, the Rambam would say you could still assure the world to come. But if someone publicly flaunts this mitzvah, doesn't care about it.
But the mitzvah of shyness, how do you know unless you go to somebody's car and go? You know, you don't know if they're wearing or wearing.
You could tell. They're experts. If you take
I'm saying if they go into public.
They say, how can you publicly?
I couldn't
look at a jacket. You're a trained guy.
You have to look at it.
If you look closely,
what's
you know.
Also, what's mad? Oh, you're not sure. But I'm saying it's a bit.
No, but I'm saying.
If the Rambam's saying that if the publicly rebel against this mitzvah, how is it a public statement? Like, you can't tell what my jacket's made out of right now. But it could be a person with a trained eye could.
Well, that's what he's saying. That's what, a trained eye.
I mean, when I take my clothes to the shotness checker, a lot of times he can look at it with his eyes and just tell what it's made out of. He doesn't need to go under a microscope.
So it doesn't have to be like a person's in public and everybody has to notice it. Just one person can notice it.
I don't know one person, but it has to be publicized. Yeah, I mean, enough people know about it, we consider it a public act. Right.
You know, brother's jacket.
Right. And this guy's wearing that jacket
and
everywhere.
Goes out
by the right. So everyone knows he's wearing that jacket. And that could be an example also. So that's considered a rebel in one area. They also have a rebel for the entire Torah. And the Rambam example is interesting. He says it's not somebody who doesn't believe in the Torah. Because someone doesn't believe in the Torah, we already discussed that in a different category. Last week we said there's somebody referred to as a mean. Or not be coerced, depending on what they're rejecting. And that's the category of somebody who rejects the Torah or rejects the rabbis. But there's this category, which is a mumar to the entire Torah. And the Rambam says it means the following, which is actually an example which happens throughout history. He says that you have people who will act as non-Jews, take on a non-Jewish religion, at a time when the non-Jews are oppressing the Jews. And they'll say, why should I remain Jewish when the Jews are so downtrodden and poor and pursued and persecuted? I'd rather cling to this other nation and, you know, and maintain my dignity and my power and my lifestyle. That's the person. So the person might say, I'm a believer. I believe in God and the Torah, but I don't want to associate with Torah because it's going to ruin my lifestyle. It's going to make me associated with these Jews who are persecuted and downtrodden. So that person is referred to as a mumar l'chol Torah kula. This person is a rebel against the entire Torah. And this person loses their share in the world to come. Now, this just brings to mind people, let's say, like the Muranos, that type of person. We don't want to cast judgment on any of these people. A lot of them do come back. But that's the type of mindset the person would have, that if I remain... So they're actually under threat of death, which might be a little bit different than this. This is, let's say, someone says, you know, I live in Poland in the year 1900, and Jews are very poor. They're not allowed to work certain professions. They can't go to certain schools. If I associate with non-Jews, they'll let me into college, I can work a better job, I can build a nicer house, they'll accept me in society. Not that they're under a threat of death, but just because they'll help them advance themselves in life. And, you know, deep down I believe in God and in the Torah, but I'm just going to act like a non-Jew so I can advance. So that would be, I think, what fits the Rambam's category. A Marano, they did it under threat of death, so I think that might be a different situation.
The way you're stating, somebody who says, I know the Torah forbids eating milk and meat together, but I'm going to do it anyhow.
Yeah.
He's saying, yeah, that the Torah is a valid set of mitzvot, and I am going to go against it anyhow. It's that form of rebellion.
Yeah.
And it's not saying, I don't believe that this is really what Hashem wants us to do.
Right, so that's the first category here, right? He's saying, I believe the Torah, this mitzvah, it says it's to anger God. You're doing it because you want to make God angry. You're being rebellious. That's that first mitzvah. If a person rejects...
It's hard to believe if somebody would say, yes, I accept that all this is true, and I'm going to go against it anyway.
Right.
It's a pretty high level of rebellion.
That's quite rebellious. But the second category is that I accept it all to be true, but I'd rather live a nicer lifestyle than not be persecuted. That's the second category. Okay, so those are the two types of mumrim. We'll call them rebels. And they lose their share in the world to come. Now we're into halacha number 10, paragraph 10. The next category is called machtiei harabim, those who cause the masses to sin. What are the examples? Whether it be in a large area of the Torah, and examples given are Yeravam, Tzadok, and Bisus. Yeravam was the first king of the kingdom of Israel. I mean, after the times of Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, the kingdom split into two, and Shlomo's son Rehoboam took over the kingdom of Judah, and Yeravam took over the kingdom of Israel, which included most of the tribes. And Yeravam was a terribly wicked person, who he prohibited his subjects from going to Jerusalem to the temple. He erected two idols that they should worship in his area. He changed the dates of the holidays. He did very terrible things. He said, we don't need these holidays, Sukkot is going to be moved over. And he was the one who we can attribute a lot of the terrible tragedy which happened during the first temple period, we can attribute to Yeravam. And it's because of him, the masses couldn't go to the temple, and they couldn't observe the Torah as they wanted to. This is right for King Solomon's times, and it's an amazing change which happened in Jewish history. So he's the one who's called Machtira. He caused the masses to sin. So he would lose his share in the world to come. He did lose his share in the world to come. The other examples are Tzadok and Bisis. Tzadok and Bisis, I think we discussed last week. Tzadok is the founder of the Sadducee movement. And the Sadducee movement, the Sadducean weather movement, which rejected the oral tradition and only accepted the written Torah. And he preached that. And therefore, he had a whole movement which rejected the core Jewish beliefs. And he was the one who founded that movement and led that movement. So that is, Tzadok and Bisis had a very similar movement as well. Those two had very similar philosophies and very similar movements. So they also lose their Shem to come. Their followers don't necessarily, but they do, because they cause the masses to sin. And then it says, so those are major areas. Those are fundamentals of Torah, which they are going up against and causing the masses to reject. But even if somebody causes one to sin in a more minor area, such as not to do a positive mitzvah. If I take somebody who wants to put on tefillin, I tie them up in the closet for the day. So then what I've done, I've caused them to sin. I've made that person not able to do a positive mitzvah, even though it might be a more minor area. That also would cause one to lose the share in the world to come, the Rambam says. So he's thinking either way, whether it be a major area like Yeravam, or even in a minor area such as keeping somebody from doing a mitzvah, so I say a positive mitzvah, and whether you do it by force or through, let's say, convincing. So it says, if you do it by force, it would be such as Menashe. Menashe was one of the most wicked kings of the Jewish people, and he forced Jews and killed the Jews unless they would worship idols. He was a Jewish king, and he would threaten us, you'd have to worship this idol or be killed. So that certainly would make him lose his share in the world to come. Or even if you convince them and persuade them into false ideologies. So it's interesting how the Rambam separates two categories. There's physical force, and there is persuasion. And it's hard to know which one's actually worse, because if you physically force someone to sin, that person still remains a believer. And that person, as soon as the pressure is lifted, is going to serve God once again. If you persuade somebody intellectually to reject Jewish beliefs, that person is now left a heretic for their entire life. So even though we picture somebody with a gun forcing you to do something wrong as a worse situation, but really, if I persuade you to believe something which is false, I've left you in a much worse situation than I would have put a gun to your head and made you do a sin one time. So Rambam says both categories would warrant one to lose their share in the world to come.
So I have an understanding question.
Yeah.
So bringing that to this day and age, I mean, these are examples from the past.
Yeah.
But in this day and age, when we have, like, reform or different denominations that, like, say, we observe Shabbos and they drive or whatever, what would that be?
Right. I mean, someone asked me last week, actually, after the class, but what I would say is this category of causing the masses to sin, if you're the one who is the leader and you're making wrong decisions for your congregation, so that person could be in this category. It's a scary thing sometimes. But everyone's looking towards this person as the leader, as their authority. And if this person's makes are against the Torah would say that is a sin. That's not God's will. So that person is causing the masses to sin. I think it could fit in. Now, the other question.
Somebody who did it unknowingly.
Unknowingly. I'm not sure. I mean, also, a lot of this is up to God to decide, obviously. I'm not sure. I mean, the Rambam says those who cause masses to sin, the examples given are those who did it knowingly. I mean, they felt it was right what they were doing, but it's not out of ignorance. They actually decided that this is the right thing to do. a lot of times someone who is a leader may never have the chance to fully study, is not privy to the traditions that we have, and therefore they might make a decision based on that. So there could be distinctions there as well. But in general, somebody who is looked towards as an authority and makes a wrong decision and misleads the masses, that person is called Machti Rabim. So again, if the person does it unknowingly, it might be a different story.
Is it worse if they afflicted a lot of people as opposed to just one person?
The example is Rabim, masses. So misleading one person obviously is a terrible thing, not necessarily by making you lose your turn in the world to come.
Okay.
But if it's Rabim, it's masses, so then that's what makes them lose their turn in the world to come. The next example is actually also a very, very important lesson for us. The next example, we're now in paragraph 11, Halacha 11. Hakorash midarchi et zibor. Somebody who separates from the ways of the community. Even though the person has not performed any transgression, but what they've done is they've disconnected with the Jewish people. They don't identify with Jewish people. They don't perform mitzvahs amongst all the Jews. They don't mourn with the Jews. They don't feel the distress of the Jewish community as a whole. They don't fast on when the Jews are fasting for different problems. Rather, they do their own thing, just like a non-Jew. So even though they observe the Torah 100%, this person doesn't identify as a Jew. So this person, then we say, they act as if they're not Jewish in terms of their emotions and connections. That person has no share in the world to come. So it's a fascinating thing that the Jewish community has to be viewed as one. We're all brothers and sisters. And I could sit, in a cave and perform every bit from the Torah, study Torah all day, daven, in terms of the rules, I'm totally righteous. But if I don't associate with the Jewish people, and when the Jews are in distress, I don't feel part of that. And when the community is fasting, I don't join in. And when the community is all working towards one cause, I don't contribute. So now I've separated from the ways of the community. And now I'm not, even though I'm acting as a Jew in terms of the laws, I'm not acting Jewish. I'm acting as if I'm not Jewish. And that will cause the person who's returning the world to come. As we said before, we say Mishnah tells us, Kol Yisrael, every member of Israel, every Jew, has a share in the world to come. You have to maintain that identity as a Jew. And most of these things are taking off your Jewish identity to some degree. So performance of mitzvot is not necessarily the only way to identify as a Jew. You have to identify with the Jews as a community, as a whole. You have to feel the unity with the Jewish people. So when there's a Jew, and that's why, we do have a beautiful Jewish community, and when Jews are in trouble, whether it be in Israel or in Europe, or in Japan, we all try to pitch in as a whole to help out. And when there's a war in Israel, us in America, we try our best to support it and to pray and to donate. And we have those feelings. And those are inherent Jewish feelings that Jew has to have. And that Jew has been closing himself off or herself off into a closet and ignore everything around them. Even though they're keeping the Torah, that Jew is their share in the world to come, the Rambam says. Yeah.
I mean, isn't there something about mental illness? One is an inclusion to that, and two, like even Moshe, like I know the Jewish people hadn't come into existence yet, but he had to move himself away from the Jews to save himself, and then he went back to help rescue everybody, but he was in Midian, right?
Right. But you could tell that he sympathized with the cause.
Right.
Before he left, he stood up for his Jewish brothers.
True.
And when he came back to save them. As soon as God said, I mean, he didn't want to be the leader. He didn't want to be the leader.
He wasn't playing for the Jews.
Right. No, he was scared for his life.
Right. Yeah. So I'm saying that there was a point in time that even Moshe was having to not be involved in the community. Whatever the reason was, so there could be an exception.
Okay, but this is a decision the person made. Moshe wasn't deciding that based on his close friends of the community, based on protecting his life. That's different. And mental illness is an exception. Mental illness, I mean, we say that somebody with mental illness, the Torah actually exempts from mitzvos in many ways. And there's a concept, onus rachman patre, something which is out of your control, God is what you're liable for. So somebody who mentally doesn't have the capacity to connect and to sympathize, so that's, God knows that, and God gave the person that challenge, and they're not going to be held accountable for not feeling distress, the Jews, around the globe.
Might be emotional.
Yeah.
How we react to these people.
That's true. Right, we have the challenge, how we treat them. That's 100% right. 100% right.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of political issues where Jews are separate. Some
many Jews don't identify with Jewhood, with Israel and stuff like that.
Well, you're right. We have to decide what is a correct issue. We can't support Jews doing the wrong thing, so that's why there's discussion. But if there's a Jew whose life's in danger, no matter who the Jew is, we have to be behind that Jew and help them. Whether the Jew is Orthodox or Reform, whether the Jew is Hasidish, Israeli, American, French, Japanese, or Australian, if it's a Jew who's in danger, everyone agrees a Jewish life is significant.
Well, right.
So then now we find the person.
The rabbis came out against letting terrorists out of jail.
Right.
Which rabbis?
Recently, I don't know if the government of Israel did that or not.
Right.
But I know that, but I mean, it's clearly they're putting Jewish lives in danger by doing it.
Okay, I mean, but these things are, if there's, you have to decide if it's a right cause or a wrong cause. Once it's considered a correct Jewish cause, then we have our community that has to find it. You know?
What about Jonathan Pollard?
Yeah.
Is that considered a correct cause?
What?
Jonathan Pollard. I mean, I guess that's...
You're right. I mean, that's something that people need to, you know, once that's decided, which I think most people would agree there is a cause.
Are you trying to say that somebody who disagrees with the majority of the Jewish community on these political issues loses their place in the world to come because they have separated themselves from the community by the criteria of the Rambam? We're getting a little off track here.
Right. No, I think what Fran's saying is that if we would all agree that Jonathan Pollard is a cause we shall support, then why are people not entering it?
If we all agree.
If we all agree. Right. The other thing is it has to be, it's a decision based on the fact, I know it's a good cause, but I'm not interested. You know, it's a Jewish cause, correct Jewish cause, but you know, I do my own thing. That's the Rambam's attitude he's trying to point out over here. Someone who says, I don't think that's a Torah cause. I don't think that that's an appropriate cause to support. That's a different discussion. Then you have to figure out, is that an appropriate cause you should be backing?
Well, I was just thinking about Reb Ali Akshev, who said it was. You know, but I guess that depends on who you go by.
Right. Yeah, I'm saying, a cause of Jonathan Pollard, I believe most rabbis tell you, is an appropriate cause to help him out. Why people don't get behind it, it's not always a decision that, you know, I don't care. A lot of times it's just laziness and the lack of, you know, whatever it is. But I can't claim I've been behind Jonathan Pollard and done much to help the situation. But the main point is, once it is an appropriate Jewish cause, then we have to feel for it. We have to be supportive of it. And he talks about also, you know, if the mass is going to do a mitzvah. You know, there is a major push that we're all going to collect money to support the shul. And, you know, let's say you're a member of this particular shul. And you say, no, I'm not interested. But the whole shul is all donating a certain amount of money in order to advance in some way. So we can't separate the communities. You can decide in your situation financially what you can afford. But to say that I'm not interested is not for me. Well, if the community is doing it, we have to get behind the mitzvah of the community. That's part of it. That's part of identifying as Jewish, is to identify with the larger Jewish community around you. Whether it be your own community in your shul, whether it be the broader Jewish community, we have to identify and feel with that community.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
We have an issue, maybe a hypothetical issue, where a new religious leader comes into your synagogue.
Yeah.
And people in your congregation, some like, some don't like.
Right.
Some would follow, some would not follow, based on...
Yeah. Right.
How do we...
So it's going back to deciding, you know, if you feel this person is not taking the synagogue in the right direction, so that's not a cause that you would need to support. You're not saying I don't identify with Jewish people or my community. I'm saying I think my community is going in the wrong direction, so I can't support that. So that's different. If you say I respect the rabbi and I like the direction it's going in, but I'm not interested in being part of this community just because I like doing my own thing, that's what I'm saying. Then you're disconnecting from the Jewish community as a whole. But this is something very practical in our lives, which we have to make sure we have those emotions and those feelings for the community beyond ourselves. It's not about me; it's about the entire community. And the Jews are all one people. You know, we have that unity and that sympathy for every single Jew which is out there. And the Rambam then continues: somebody who performs sins biyad ramah is the lashon. Yad ramah typically is with a, let's call it a public display of, the best word I would say is chutzpahdik. You know, in a way which is showing, it's with this audacity that I just couldn't care less about this area of the Torah, and the person does it publicly. Again, whether it be lighter areas of the Torah, more serious areas of the Torah, that person was the Shem will to come. And this is referred to, the Hebrew term he uses, Megale Panim B'Torah. This person is exposing his face, the Torah, as the Rambam understands it. Meaning, you're acting with chutzpah for the Torah. You're looking at Torah in the eye and saying, I don't care. And it may not be one particular, we talked before of one particular area. It could be this happens in different areas of the Torah. You know, sometimes you do it. But that person has that attitude towards the Torah. Since the person acts with such audacity and such nerve, and has no shame in front of God's Torah, that itself also warrants losing a share in the world to come. The Gemara lists that there is three innate Jewish traits. It says that we are, Vaishanim. One of those is Vaishanim, which we'd say means that there is a certain level of modesty. I guess a good translation. Meaning that I'm not going to stand up and fight back at these things and act with chutzpah, but I'm going to act a little bit more, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a better English word. A little more restraint, a little more respect. We say we're Rahman and we're merciful, and we're Gomi Chassad and we do chesed. We do charity to others. Those are three innate Jewish traits we get from the patriarchs. So somebody who acts with chutzpah and without busha is the opposite of chutzpah. You know, instead of acting with this nerve, we're supposed to act with a little bit of reserve, a little modesty. A person who is willing to flaunt the Torah in a way which we regard as chutzpahdik, so that person loses their share in what's to come. Yeah?
What are the three? Same three again.
Rahmanim, we have mercy, we're merciful. Vaishanim, we have this level of modesty. And Gomi Chassadim, we do chesed to others. Those are three traits of a Jew.
Trying to figure the difference between the one who performs sins proudly, chutzpahdik, in public.
Yeah.
How is that different from somebody who rebels against one mitzvah? Or that what we covered back in the law?
Because the one who rebels against one mitzvah, he's made that one mitzvah he has now erased from his Torah, basically. The guy who's acting chutzpahdik, it could be that, you know, 1 week it'll be in kashrus. Next week he keeps kosher, but it'll be Shabbos the following week. And the following week it'll be sukkahs. And the next week it will be stealing.
And this is not yet rejecting the entire Torah because he hasn't done it all and he's doing
right.
It
Right, it's just an attitude.
This week he's keeping Shabbos and not kashrus.
Right.
And next week he's keeping Shabbos and not
kashrus. Right. Okay. It's an attitude that, you know, God can't tell me what to do. I'm going to do what I want to do. And I know I listen to God sometimes, and I respect God.
But
it's
somehow different from what was back in Halacha 9.
It's somewhat, what?
It's different from what was back in Halacha
9. Right. In Halacha 9, it was saying that, I mean, obviously there's some chutzpah involved there too. But I'm not saying I do what I want to do. I'm saying that, you know, God has the right to dictate my life, and the whole Torah is great. But this one area I don't like, so I'm just going to reject it and rebel against it. It's a different type of attitude.
Is it a difference if it's like a teenager who's going through something and, you know, they need to get support versus an adult who has already made choices, or is it the same?
Those distinctions are up to God. It's hard to know the distinctions. I mean, God knows the situation. God knows why the person did what they did, where they come, what are their pressures, what are their challenges. And, you know, God has to decide if that person meets the category or not. I mean, certainly a teenager who is acting rebellious, it's a very different situation than an adult acting rebellious. You know, teenagers act rebellious all the time. You know, by the time we're adults, hopefully we have, you know, settled down and we're acting in a more stable way. A teenager's decision to rebel is not always based on logic. You know, it's not rational. It's just that's what teenagers do sometimes. It's a different story. But bottom line, you know, that kind of distinction, God sees through the person and knows why they did what they did. And deep down, that teenager is acting rebellious. Deep down, it could be that they're doing it for a very different reason. You know, they're trying to get attention. You know, they're trying to have a sense of self, but not because they have anything against the Torah or against God. You know, the adult, it could be that, it could be the same thing. It could be they have something against God, and they really want to rebel. So it's very different. Let's go to number 12. Next, we have a category which, unfortunately, also has been a problem with Jewish history, which is referred to as a moser. A moser is one who is going to give, Rambam will explain it right now, somebody who is going to turn over Jews or Jewish money to the non-Jewish government. He says there's two examples. The first is turning over a Jew to the non-Jews to be killed or to be beaten up. That's the first category. So the Rambam, it sounds like according to the Rambam, if you were to give a Jew to put into jail, they would not fall into this category, according to the Rambam. Rambam says you give the Jew over for execution or to be physically beaten. That falls in this category. So, it's happened in Jewish history when there's been disputes in Jewish communities, they've been involved in non-Jewish government. And they would go and slander a certain Jew, and the non-Jewish government would take that Jew and execute them, or throw them into prison, or beat them up. I mean, you could read historically, you could read that's happened, unfortunately, many times. And that would be, seems to be the category of a moser. I mentioned last week how, at what point, if a Jew is performing illegal activities, at what point do you report them to the police in a non-Jewish land? Where in America, if unfortunately you see a Jew acting in a way which is illegal, when can you report to the police? So that's a question which rabbis have discussed at length, and if it ever comes up, hopefully not, if it comes up, speak to your rabbi, and you'll figure it out. Especially the question I mentioned last week has come up with child molesters, things like that. And that's, you know, at what point do you say if you see a Jewish, God forbid, child molester, you turn them into the police or not? When it threatens other people, there's much more of a reason to turn them in than if it's not threatening other people in that way. The next category is not...
The Jewish money.
That's about to read right now, Jewish money. The Rambam then says somebody who turns over his friends, his Jewish friends' money into the hands of non-Jews or into the hands of, let's say, burglars, things like that. So they also have no share in the world to come. This one's actually kind of surprising to us because it doesn't seem to be such a terrible act. But let's say, and obviously if it's legal what's happening, that's one category. But let's say you're doing it, you know, illegally. You know, whether you steal, whether you trick your friend into giving his money over, but that's also to be considered losing a share in the world to come. And I guess the point is, in all these ideas, is that what you're doing, you're associating and empathizing more with the non-Jews than with the Jews. And as we said, that if you can maintain your identity as a Jew, that guarantees you a share in the world to come. And these acts are all are distancing you from being labeled Jewish. Obviously, halachically, you're still Jewish. But your identity is now more with the non-Jews than the Jews. That caused the person to lose their share in the world to come. So by saying, I want this non-Jew to have this money, and I'm going to take it out, funnel it away from the Jewish community, so then you're identifying more with the non-Jew than with the Jewish community. And certainly a Jewish life, if you're going to say, I'm going to take this Jewish life and turn it over to the non-Jews to execute, then you're identifying more with the non-Jewish cause than the Jewish cause. Again, if it's charity and you're doing it willingly, that's okay. But moser means that you're against your friend's will, you're taking his money and giving it over to non-Jews. If you want to support a non-Jewish charity, that's fine. That's your decision. That's you know, fine and recommended. It's a nice thing to do. It creates peace in the world. It you know, creates friendly relationships. But you know, if your friend does not want to give his money to a non-Jewish cause, and you force that him somehow, so that could fall into the category of moser. The next category, which is number...
Why does it also count as stealing his money?
It probably would too, but that's not as severe to make you lose your
world
to come.
You don't lose the world to come.
Right.
You can do tshuva.
Right. I mean, all these you can do tshuva on as well, but if somebody dies with this sin still in the record, they lose their world to come. Rambam at the end of this chapter is going to tell us everything here tshuva could bring atonement. The person can be forgiven through tshuva. All these things, as terrible as they are. But if somebody dies, and this is still in the record books, and they were tshuva, that's no big problem. Number 13, this is paragraph 13, halacha 13. There's another interesting one. It's called Matile Emal Atzibur Shlul Hashem Shemayim. Somebody who is going to assert their authority on the congregation, not for the sake of heaven. Such as somebody who forcibly will rule over a community, and people are scared of this person. This person is a very threatening personality. And this leader's intent is only for their own personal honor and not for the honor of God. So that person will lose their share in the world to come. So Jewish communities need leaders, and need strong leaders, as we all know. And we really hope and pray and trust that our leaders are there with sincere intentions and are devoted to the community, not to themselves. When you have a leader who takes power and asserts their authority for their own personal honor and fame and advancement, nothing to do with the advancement of the community and for God's glory, that person is something falls into this category. So, I mean, you find, in the Pirkei Avos, you find very often the warning that it's kind of, in some ways, it's scary to be a leader. It's good to avoid leadership because it's a dangerous situation, because if you're a leader and you do the wrong thing, then you're held accountable. So, and as we know, you know, power corrupts. That's human reality. And very often, a leader will enjoy the honor, will enjoy the power and the fame. And sometimes decisions are made which may not be the best for the community, but it's better for their own personal advancement. And if the community feels threatened by this person, and this person keeps asserting their authority in ways which make the community feel scared and threatened of the, and supporting this person based on fear, that person will lose their share and will become the Rambam says. And again, I think what that person is doing, he's taking a position of Jewish leadership, but not doing it in a Jewish manner. So again, he's not identifying as a Jew. A Jewish leader has to promote Jewish causes and promote the glory of God. And if you're a Jewish leader and all you're doing is promoting yourself, and that is now disassociating yourself with the Jewish community. The Rambam then says, and now we're to 14. We've now listed all 24 of these categories. So he says every single one of these 24 categories that we've counted, even though technically they're Jewish, they've lost their share in the world to come, as we've explained, because they've in some way disassociated themselves with the community. But then he says a very interesting thing. If there are some smaller transgressions, even though they seem to be minor, the rabbis tell us if you are ragil, which means you are habitually performing these transgressions, you have no share in the world to come. And therefore, we have to distance ourselves from these actions, because if they become part of our routine, it's a big problem. What are these actions? So he first says, and this one actually is a challenge for some and surprising to us. It says, somebody who creates a nickname for another person, and somebody calls a person by their nickname. Now the nickname here, it's seemingly means a less than honorable nickname. You know, you're calling the person a name which they may find offensive, insulting, embarrassing. But you create that nickname, or you constantly call them by this nickname, and the person doesn't want to be called by this nickname. They want to be called by their real name. So that person, if this becomes a habit, the person can lose their share in the world to come. So you think about, like, you know, teenagers calling their friends these nicknames. These things stick sometimes. And time goes on, it becomes the person's nickname, it becomes the person's name. If the person doesn't like it, and the person feels offended or insulted by it, certainly the fault of this category is actually a scary thing. Why this is considered such a severe transgression, I don't have an answer, I'm not sure. The Gemara says
just... It says it's flawed. It says it's minor, right?
He says, yeah, but it makes the person lose their share in the world to come. So you could be a thief for 40 years and you still have a share of the world to come. But if you've called your friends, you know, four eyes, you know, for 10 years,
I could tell you, my birth name is Judy.
Okay.
And when people who know that, when they want to be cute, they'll call me Judith. Well, my father and mother, I feel it's this dishonor to them.
Right.
And so calling, and that's not even a nickname, really. You know, that's not a nickname. So I can understand that it's not just a dishonor to you, it's a dishonor to
your parents.
Well,
thank
you. I can really appreciate that.
Right, that's interesting.
I'm not saying it warrants, you know,
right.
But I could understand the depth of that.
Right, it's interesting. I guess also it can make a person feel a loss of identity. If you're always called this negative nickname, so you lose who you really are sometimes, and you start picturing yourself in different ways, it can actually affect you psychologically in many ways as well. The Rambam then says, next, Hamalbim Pnei Chaver Barav, this is a famous one, if you embarrass another human being publicly. This comes from Pirkei Avos. If you embarrass someone else publicly, you lose your share, again, on a regular basis, the Rambam says, you lose your share in the world to come. The Gemara actually compares embarrassing somebody publicly to death. And so it says it could be in times better for a person to jump into a fiery furnace, the Gemara says, rather than embarrass their friend publicly. And the source of that is actually from the Torah, from the story of Yehuda and Tamar. Because Yehuda and Tamar, they had a relationship which was inappropriate, and Tamar was being taken, they were taking her to be executed. And rather than pointing out and saying he did it, she kept quiet. So they were about to burn her, and she kept quiet. He came and confessed. But why did she keep quiet? Because she understood that it's better to die than to embarrass them publicly. And the Maharal points out, the famous commentary of the Maharal, he says that, you know, when you die, there's a physical death involved. When you embarrass somebody, so physically they're fine, but you've taken a hit on their soul. That's what you've done. Because embarrassment really is when the soul feels uncomfortable. Embarrassment is an expression of the soul, not an expression of the body. Maral says that killing somebody, you've killed the body, but the soul is left intact. When you bury somebody, you've actually struck their soul. That's what you've done. That's why it's such a terrible thing. You have a question?
No, I just think, I think you could have came forward after she said who's the owner of these things.
Right.
He didn't volunteer.
He didn't volunteer, yeah. Okay, fine. Right.
He didn't know
it was him.
Right.
That's his fault
right.
until that. But he did come forth and confess, but she never pointed out and said, Yehuda, it was you. Right. She never did that.
Right.
The Rambam continues. He says, Hamiskar bekalun chavero. If you gain honor through your friend's embarrassment. So let's say you have a colleague at work, and you'd love to advance beyond this colleague, not because you're just better than them, not necessarily based on your merits, and the colleague makes a mistake, and you get so excited now because now they're all going to give you the honor and the glory, and you use that as a stepping stone for advancement. As an example, so that could be that you are honoring yourself through your friend's mistakes, through your friend's downfall, your friend's embarrassment. And again, Rambam says these have to be, if they're ragil, if they're routine, this is something which a person does commonly, and they lose their share in the world to come. A one-time shot won't do it, but if it's part of the person's common way of acting, they lose their share in the world to come. Rambam then says, somebody who ridicules or embarrasses Torah scholars, and again, somebody who ridicules or embarrasses their rabbis, someone ridicules and embarrasses the holidays. All of those three types of ridicule also cause someone to lose the share in what to come. So if somebody is going to start making fun of a certain rabbi out there, again, somebody if it's somebody who has really objectively done the wrong thing, then it's a different discussion. Somebody who's a distinguished person, honorable person, and we start, the word used is mevaze, which means to ridicule or denigrate, somehow defame this person. So that makes the person lose their share in the world to come. And the same thing is true with their own rabbis and with holidays. And then we say also somebody who profanes things which are holy, which literally it's referring to if you had meat of a sacrifice, you treat that inappropriately. That was the context of it. Which nowadays we don't have that. If you have meat from a sacrifice, which is considered kachim, holy meat, and you don't treat that with the proper respect on a routine basis, it also causes someone to lose a share in the world to come. So those are all examples of sins that we see is not as so severe, not as so important, but yet if it becomes part of a routine, the rabbis tell us the person loses their share. Now the Rambam tells us a very important point. The Rambam says, where does all this apply? That's only if the person dies and has not yet done teshuvah on any of these sins. But somebody who has done teshuva and then dies, that person is considered a baal teshuva. The person's teshuva is accepted. This person will merit a share in the world to come because nothing stands in the way of teshuva. And this is something which we all have to know and repeat to ourselves over and over again. Nothing stands in the way of teshuva. Teshuva is always accepted. In the next chapter, the Rambam is going to list things which prevent us from doing teshuva. But if we can overcome those challenges, teshuva is still accepted. And we'll talk about that, I guess, next week. The Rambam says, even somebody who is a heretic their entire life, and on the very last day of life, they did sincere teshuva, the person has a share in the world to come. As it says, Shalom, Shalom, L'rachuk L'krov. God offers peace to those who are distant and those who are close. Even if someone is very, very distant from God, peace is offered to them as well, as long as they've done teshuva. Then it says, all of the wicked people, all of the rebels, all those that we've discussed, that perform teshuva, whether they perform teshuva externally, or whether it was merely an internal teshuva, that's also accepted. So that's also, this person, from what we can see, is still acting in these despicable ways. But in their hearts, they've had a change of heart. And in their hearts, they sincerely returned to God. They haven't been able yet to change their actions. It's also accepted. The person will get a share in the world to come that way. So that's also a fascinating thing. Teshuva is not an all-or-nothing process, as we said before. Somebody can have sincere feelings in their hearts, and they haven't been able to bring it out into action quite yet. So God sees that as well. And even if it's one of these people who seem to be horrible people, doing despicable things, but since in their heart they have devoted themselves more to God in a sincere manner, that will be accepted, and that will help the merit of share in the world to come as well. And he quotes from a verse that says, Shuvu banim shovivim, you should return those children who are rebellious, even though the person still appears rebellious, but
in their hearts they have returned to God, that teshuvah is accepted. So we'll end by wanting to add in one more point. It's an interesting point, which also relates to the next chapter, which we'll do next week, God willing. The Gemara discusses one of the rabbis whose name was Elisha ben Abuya, and he is a rabbi who actually turned into a heretic. You know, you don't find these stories too often throughout the Talmud. But there's one rabbi who was really, he was a teacher of some of our greatest rabbis, Rabbi Meir's teacher. He lived in the times, I guess it was Rabbi Akiva's time. This is the time where you had really great scholars, and he was considered a great scholar. And he actually became a heretic. And there's stories of him riding around on a horse on Shabbos, and Rabbi Meir is following him and asking him questions. And he still knows all the answers, but he wasn't observing the halacha. And they came to call him Acher. They didn't call him by his name, they called him Acher, the other. They didn't call him by his name anymore. Originally his name was Elisha ben Abuya. And the Gemara tells us that every single day, a heavenly voice cries out from Mount Sinai. And it says, Shuvah banim shovavim. There's rebellious children. Do teshuvah, repent, come back. And in his time, that voice would say, everyone should repent except for Acher. He should repent. Everyone else should come back and not him. That's what it says. Now the Rambam tells us, and he'll tell us again and again, that everyone can do teshuvah. Now nothing stands before teshuvah. There's nobody who can't do teshuvah. As terrible as a person can become, even if you are somebody like Acher, who was one of the greatest Talmudic scholars at a certain point, and a leader of these people, who then became a heretic and threw off Torah, he also did the teshuvah. But the voices from Mount Sinai came out and said, everybody should do teshuvah besides Acher. That's what the Gemara tells us. So commentaries explain that what does it mean that he couldn't do teshuvah? It doesn't mean he couldn't do teshuvah. Everyone can do teshuvah. But it means that he didn't have, we all have heavenly assistance when we do teshuvah. The rabbis tell us, if you come to do the right thing, God assists you. If you want to do teshuvah, God will push you along and help you out. Acher reached a point, he was so wicked, God says, I'm not helping you out, you're on your own. The heavenly voice from Mount Sinai is a sign of divine assistance. Daily there's this voice, this heavenly voice pushing you, do teshuvah, become better, be a better person, I'm there behind you, I'm there to help you. Acher reached a point where God says, I'm not giving you any help, you want to do it on your own, that's fine, go for it, but I'm not here to help you. And we'll discuss next week that there are 24 different things which prevent teshuvah, but all these things are just obstacles in our way. But ultimately, nothing stands in front of teshuvah, and if we try, we're sincere, and we push, we have the ability to change ourselves, return to God, and God will accept us for what we are. So that's the story of Acher, but it ties into the Rambam, because Rambam says nothing stands in teshuvah's way. Ein davar umin pnei teshuvah. So we have to know in our lives, no matter what we've done, no matter how difficult it is, no matter what challenges come our way, teshuvah is always an option. And even if we think, I've been doing this for a year, and there's no way I can change, teshuvah is always there, and if we do teshuvah, God is there behind us to assist and to help. Okay.